This is right off the transcript. This is the podcast where Pastor James or myself will be reading right off of our sermon transcripts. Hopefully, recapping sermons you've heard or maybe sermons you've missed. So whatever this is for you, we hope that you enjoy it and it's worthwhile for you. Shoot Pastor James an email. He is not quite willing to go and do this, but I'm all for it. So you'll be hearing from me and maybe Pastor James in the next few weeks. So thanks for listening. We'll see you on the podcast. Well, what follows is part one of, I believe, a 10-part series on who God is in essence, in spirit, in Jesus. And I began teaching this actually to my high school students at the time. The very first one of these teachings was given on a mountainside in Joshua Tree. We did it almost pitch dark because we had a hard time putting up the tent. But it was a really powerful moment, I think, to explore the passage that we're going to explore, as you see. So stay tuned for right off the transcript, this segment where we're going to just look at old sermons that myself or Pastor James have given. So thanks for listening. We hope that it's good. So guys, I'm just going to get started. This is the very first one. It's called Yahweh is Our God. It was in a series, I'll just get into it. I've never really done this before, but I'm in the office. I have a cup of coffee. I have this new mic in front of me, and we're just going to get going. I haven't adapted any of the transcript for no audience or no congregation in front of me, so let's see how it goes. What do Christians mean when we use the word G-O-D? I think that there's actually a lot of ambiguity or fogginess for Christians in America when we use the word, because we often assume that everybody who uses the word God is talking about the same exact thing. And I'm pretty convinced that we're actually not talking about the same, referring to the same being a lot of the time. And that's just within the church. But within Western culture in general, it gets even more complicated. And it's funny because in American media and politics, the word God gets brought up quite a lot. And the general assumption is that we all know what we're talking about when we use that word, or that we're all talking about the same thing or the same being. And as Christians, I think we need to begin to discipline our thinking and to think carefully and intentionally about who we're referring to when we use this word. Another major factor is that we all come to our definition or what we understand about the word God and who it refers to. We all come to this definition by lots of different means. One could be the ethnic background, our experiences growing up in certain homes, by our cultural and geographical backgrounds. Another major factor, at least for cities, especially in America, is the fact that over the last 50 years or so, with increased immigration and then mobility in the world's urban centers, people moving from international cities, America has become what America was 200 years ago, a melting pot of culture. So odds are, if you were born in the 70s, 80s, or 90s, you grew up in the city that you grew up, and you grew up in the city, then you grew up just knowing people who are of different religious backgrounds. And that's a relatively new experience. And so you had different religious experiences than your grandparents would have had if you're a mainstream American or immigrant to America. Our cities are much more diverse than any of the rural places or even the suburbs. So you, at any given moment in a city like Los Angeles, you can have a Chinese Buddhist or a Catholic from Spain or a Catholic from Ireland, which are widely different, or a Catholic from the mountains in Mexico, even more different, or a Catholic from urban Manila. And then you might have a Hindu from India right next to you at work. And then you have wherever you happen to grow up in and all the religious backgrounds that come with that. And then people learn English with all of these different religious and cultural backgrounds, but English has one word to talk about all of those different divine reference, to talk about God, quote unquote. But all of these people don't mean the same thing when they use that one English word, God. And so this is the reality of living in a religious and culturally pluralistic society. And you just need to gain an understanding, not just for your own sake, but also for the sake of understanding who that person is that you're trying to get to know. What God are you trying to relate to in some way and trying to understand and connect with? And so one reason we have such difficulty in relating to God is because we have such a muddled idea of who God is in our minds, but we have a word for it that we think we know what it means. We take for granted. So think of it this way, and hopefully this will help underscore the point. This was actually a congregational thing, but it should work if you could just run it through in your head. So do you know John? Just really think about that question. Raise your hand or raise your hand in your mind if you know somebody named John. And keep that mental hand raised if you know more than one person named John, even if he's a celebrity or a fictional character. So how many Johns do you think there are in the world presently and also in history? So keep that mental hand raised if you agree with my guess the number of Johns there might be in America, at least. Just America. How many Johns are there in America? Maybe 5, maybe 10, maybe 20, 40, 400, 600, 1 million? I did the research, and as of 2019, there are over 5.3 million Johns in the United States. And that's just people who have John only as their first name. Not referring to John Marks, John Lewis, John Pauls. So the word John isn't helpful if you're going to answer my question if you know John. If you want to answer it well, you need to know a little bit more, because I could be talking about any John. So how can we gain clarity on which John I was referring to when I asked the question? What more do you want to say or know about the John I'm referring to? What questions would you ask? You'd ask their full name, but that would only get you a step of the way to figuring out which John I'm referring to, until you realize that there's actually a huge number of John Mayers in America. Even if I was referring to John Mayer, there's actually a few John Mayers too. So how do you further clarify which John Mayer I'm talking about? And you can't say middle name because that's a loophole in the analogy, but let's focus. Let's not focus on that, but well, let's focus on the just John and Mayer. How can we go about knowing which specific John Mayer I'm referring to? Well, there's plenty of ways of doing it, but the easiest way is to tell their story. So the John Mayer I'm referring to was born in Bridgeport, Connecticut. The John Mayer who has won 7 Grammy Awards. The John Mayer who dated Taylor Swift. Someone's name and someone's story. That's typically how we identify people, by their name and by their story. And so this is not complicated. You're not learning anything right now. This is fairly easy, but it's just so commonplace when it comes to people that it's funny that we never think to use the same kinds of ideas or categories when it comes to the lowercase G-O-D. So what God are we talking about? It would help to know this particular God's story. It would help to know which particular God we're talking about, and also to know if this God has maybe other names or a more specific name other than the generic title of God or deity, right? It's helpful to note that God is not a name. And as Christians, both of those are incredibly important things to know and understand, that the God revealed in Jesus has a name and has a story. So think about the first sentence of the Bible. I'm going to take a sip of the coffee. Turn to page 1 of your Bible. What's the title for God in the first sentence of the Bible? Right? Okay, God. So, of course, you're going to learn Hebrew. And if you're just listening to this on a drive, feel free to say it out loud. You're going to learn Hebrew. And the Hebrew word for God is the word Elohim. Elohim. Elohim, right? You can say it with me. Elohim. So Elohim is the same in Hebrew as it is in English. It's another generic word referring to a divine being. So here's something interesting to think about. So if you only know the first sentence of the Bible, you've narrowed down the list pretty good, because we're talking about gods who have the power or the generosity or the creativity to spin a world into being, right? God created the heavens and the earth. So that takes a bunch of deities off the list right there, because we're not referring to those beings who have not done this. because not all gods can do that kind of thing. But many religions or cultures believe in some kind of being that did this. So the first sentence of the Bible narrows the list kind of, but not entirely. So you still don't know what kind of creator we're talking about. So what do you do next? So as what you do is you learn as a Christian to develop a discipline of reading the Bible. It's a practice, a discipline of reading the Bible as a way of helping you to clarify things about the identity of God and letting these stories challenge and shape your thinking about the character qualities and the purposes of this God that we say we believe in. And that's not always easy because the Bible is not in English. The Bible is in Hebrew, Aramaic, there's Egyptian in it. There's Old Arabic, there's Greek, Latin. So it's not immediately clear oftentimes. So we have to develop the discipline of reading and then allow ourselves to be shaped by it. And to do that, you simply have to continue reading on in the story with that lens on. Just pay attention to information that's coming in. So if you're at home and just listening to this, grab your Bible. Turn to the book of Exodus, chapter 2. If you're not at home and you're listening in on a drive, then take note, take mental note. So we're going to ponder and contemplate a story that both reveals the name and the story of God in just a really significant chapter from Exodus, one of my favorites. So that's a cop-out. I always say whatever I'm reading is my favorite, but I digress. Exodus chapter 2, verse 23, we'll dive right in. Here it is. During that long period, the king of Egypt died. The Israelites groaned in their slavery and cried out, and their cry for help because of their slavery went up to God. Okay, so pause. Beep. We're jumping right off into the middle of a fast-paced developing story. There was something that happened in chapter 1, right? And in Genesis, the entire book. So, but we're hopping right in. So there's this God who created and spun a world into being. And he commissioned a particular creature that he made in his world. And he called this creature, here's another Hebrew word, Adam, which means humanity. It's where we get our name Adam. And Adam, humanity, was made in the image of, made to reflect the Creator's image out into the world. And they're very much partners with the Creator God in responsibility and management of the flourishing of God's good world. And God gives them a real responsibility. That's Genesis chapter 1, 2. And two, so it's real responsibility, real dignity, real freedom, real choice of how they're going to go about building this world. Building this world with God, and how does the story with God go? So page two of the Bible, it goes okay for a little bit, but by page three, it doesn't go well at all. And the creatures begin to doubt the Creator's goodness, and they believe the Creator's holding out on them. And instead of trusting the Creator's definitions for good, what is good and for flourishing and bad for flourishing, they seize the opportunity, and then they begin to define good and evil for themselves. And they do this in ways that are most convenient for themselves, and it leads to the ruin of our world, as the story of the Bible continues on to tell us. So what do we learn about the Creator God just from, you know, that little quick little expanse, that quick little traversal of Genesis 1 to Exodus 2? That this Creator God is so passionate and committed to the goodness of this world and committed to these human beings that have totally turned away from him, that he sets in motion a plan to rescue and to bless and to redeem this and to save this humanity and this world. And so he does that by this conversation with this random guy named Abraham. And he says, through you and your family, I'm going to do something that's going to bring blessing and salvation to all the nations. And so this is the God that we're dealing with all the way up to Exodus 2. So we'll keep reading Exodus 2 now. God, or Elohim, he heard Israel's groaning, and he remembered his covenant. With whom? Right? Abraham. With Isaac and with Jacob. So it's all drawing on that story. So 25, God looked on the Israelites. He was concerned about them. So this people group is crucial to God's plan somehow. We don't know yet how. You just got to keep reading the story to figure out how. But he's going to bring blessing and salvation to all of the nations through this family. That's the goal. So we're using this generic title, Elohim, but we're cluing into God's story. This is the particular God who made a covenant with Abraham, through whose family he's going to somehow bring blessing and salvation to the world. So God looks on and he's concerned because Abraham's family is in slavery in Egypt and in pain. And oh my goodness, what is God going to do? Chapter 3, verse 1. So now there's a guy named Moses, and he was tending the flock of Jethro, his father, father-in-law, the priests of Midian, and he led the flock to the far side of the wilderness, and he came to Horeb, which is the mountain of God. Now, so let's pause. This is a good Old Testament style of storytelling, because we just got clued in, oh man, God listened. What is he going to do? How is he going to save these people? And then all of a sudden, oh no, why are we looking at Moses? I just want to know what God's going to do to rescue the people. And then now I'm looking at Moses, some guy who's tending the flock, And so this is a literary art, and it's good storytelling because there's some connection and you don't know yet how, but you have to read the story to figure that out. So there's this guy named Moses, and you know about him from chapter 2. He was drawn out of the water, right? Everybody's seen the movie. But he's leading his flock to the far side of this mountain, and he comes to a mountain that's called Horeb. If you read, it's another name in the Bible. It has another name out in the Bible called Sinai. And that's where the Israelites are going to go on later in the book of Exodus. So he's out there cruising with his flock, and then there's an angel, not of Elohim, but of, what's it say? It says Lord. And so this is something I've mentioned a few times before in other sermons. But when you see the Lord, the word L-O-R-D in all capital letters in your Bible, it's kind of funny because why are they spelling this in different letters? But that's how the English translators are giving you a little clue that the Hebrew word is used is not just the word for master or for Lord, but it's actually the divine name. And so that's going to be revealed in this story later on that we're reading. But so the traditional and most likely way that this name was pronounced by ancient Israelites is Yahweh, Yahweh. And this story, it's likely, we don't know how it's pronounced actually, but it's likely that it was pronounced Yahweh. And this story is actually about the revelation of that name and the meaning of that name. And so it's the angel of Yahweh that appears to Moses, and he appears in the flames of a fire from within a bush. So now Moses saw that even though the bush was on fire, it didn't burn up, right? And that's a little strange, I think, because you would freak out if you saw a bush that maybe wouldn't freak out. You'd think it's interesting, but you wouldn't be just nonplussed. You would notice it, and it's strange to see a bush on fire and it's not burning up or being consumed. Right? But it's not strange to see a bush on fire. It's strange to see a bush on fire that's not burning up. And that's why Moses thought, oh, what's going on? Well, I guess I better go over and see this strange sight. And why does this bush not burn up? Now, when Yahweh saw that he had gone over to look, God called to him from within the bush, Moses, Moses. And Moses said, Here I am. So the bush is talking. It calls out to Moses just when he was motioning over to come to the bush or to look. And verse 5, don't come any closer, God said. Take off your sandals, for the place on which you stand is holy ground. So there's another way that the story is trying to shape our view and the view of the character of God and the attributes of this Yahweh, of this Elohim who is named Yahweh. Yahweh Elohim. And so this God is holy. This particular Elohim is holy. This God doesn't mean, holy doesn't mean moral goodness or like being uptight or being a goody two-shoes. Like, oh, she thinks she's just so holy. Not that. That's what it's come to mean in our culture, but that's not what it means in the Bible. In the Bible, this word means unique. It means different. It means utterly other. And it's foremost used of Yahweh Elohim. that this God is so utterly different and other and unique and transcendent that within God's own self, he has the resources to spin out a universe into being. And this God is the very definition of creativity and justice and moral goodness and beauty and purity and so on. So to come into the presence of such an utterly unique being means to come into the proximity of unique and sacred and holy space, just like you would never... So I had a friend growing up. I don't know why, but when I would go to his house, he would take off his shoes and his mom would get on him for this because he would bring his shoes right into the house. And the first room when you walk in is the kitchen and he put them on the counter. He threw his shoes right onto the kitchen counter. And that's a no-no in an Asian household, but this guy was not Asian. And so his mom right away told him pretty firmly to take his nasty shoes off the counter. And what she's not happy about that for the same reasons, similar reasons that Moses was supposed to take off his shoes, right? Because what were my friend and I walking on in Carson and Sepulveda, right? Oil from cars, shoes, animal pee, cigarette butts, and he would bring that into the house and put it on the kitchen counter, which are used for what? What's their unique and specified purpose that makes them different surfaces than any other surface in the house? Right? They're used for the preparation of food. And so that's a sacred, unique, and holy space that's for that purpose, for food. And what my friend tracks in off the street does not belong on that counter. So it's a similar principle right here. Moses is a shepherd, so he's probably walked, you know, in a couple of sheep pies or sheep poo-poos, and you have to take them off because this is a unique experience. This is a unique and holy being that you're coming into proximity with. And this God, this Elohim, further clarifies his identity about what he's about. So verse 6, then I said, I am the Elohim of your father, the Elohim of Abraham, the Elohim of Isaac, the Elohim of Jacob. He's identifying himself through this story of what God has been up to. At this, Moses hid his face. He was afraid to look at God. Then Yahweh said, I've indeed seen the misery of my people in Egypt. I've heard them crying out because of their slave drivers. I am concerned about their suffering, so I've come down to rescue them from the hand of the Egyptians, to bring them out of that land and into a good and spacious land, a land flowing with milk and honey. That's why my God voice, apparently. Which doesn't mean that the rocks are going to be oozing milk and honey, right? Because that's what I thought absolutely as a kid. But what makes milk? Goats, cows. What makes honey? Bees. In other words, just by itself, with no tending, this land is producing sheep and bees. It's flowing with resources. That's the idea. And it's the home of these people groups already. These people groups that he lists, the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, the Jebusites. And so now the cry of the Israelites has reached me. I have seen the way the Egyptians are oppressing them. Now go, I'm sending you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt. Again, if our stories reveal who we are, then what does this story reveal about Yahweh Elohim? It reveals that this God cares deeply about how human beings treat each other. That's just put at its most basic. So this is a God who cares deeply about how his image-bearing creatures are treating what other image-bearing creatures. And when there's oppression or evil or injustice, this God cares and internalizes the pain and the grief and is driven to do something in response. So now this God is driven to do something, and what does this God do? How does this God choose to act? So God says, I heard, I'm going to do something. And what does he do? He says, Moses, you go. And so we think, why doesn't God just do it himself? Get directly involved. And so now I have to say, stop. Stop it. Stop it. Right? You have a view of God that if God is going to be involved in the world, it means that he drops down miracles from heaven and then moves the world on a string. That's how we think God ought to act. But if you've actually ever read the Bible and you realize that it's almost how God never acts, very rare are the moments where God actually acts in history without any human mediation whatsoever. So if you actually read a story about this God named Yahweh Elohim, he almost always acts through his people, through commissioning people. And we might say that's a pretty darn inefficient way of working because people are not the best and they often get it wrong. So clearly, according to the story, efficiency is just not one of the huge cares of this God, right? That this God has other high items on his agenda that he's going to get done more than just simply being efficient, namely the shaping and the cultivation of the character of his people, which is just going to take time. So he's going to send Moses. I'm going to send you to Pharaoh. Bring my people, Israelites, out of Egypt. What does Moses think of this plan? Bad idea, bad idea, bad idea, right? His first response is an objection. He says, who am I? Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt? And God's response, what does he do? God responds to the question by ignoring Moses' question. Right? Look, what did God say? He said, I will be with you. Just think about that, right? Who am I? I'm not your guy. I'm not qualified. I don't actually even want to go. Who am I that I should go? And God says, in essence, actually, it doesn't matter who you are. What matters is who I am and what I am, and what I am is with you. So go. So do you get what's happening there? This is a really important moment in the story of Israel, right? And this is very powerful if you can connect the dots. So I'm going to teach you the Hebrew word for I will be. It's a sentence and it's one word in Hebrew. I will be. Because it's all connected. If you don't know the Hebrew, this kind of like nuance of significance is lost. But I'm going to bring it to you right here. So God says, I will be with you, right? So God says, I will be. And how you say that in Hebrew is a very, very breathy word, which you should say after eating Korean barbecue or pork belly. Everybody's watching that pork belly Netflix series. But eat it, you know, say this word after you eat Korean barbecue and eat a lot of garlic. Because the word right here is, and I have a mic, so it's going to sound nice. The word is, yeah. Okay, I got really close to the mic. So write that down and put I will be next to it. Yeah. Okay, so it's exciting, right? Sorry also if that it was a gross thing to hear, my mouth noises. But this is exciting because the Hebrew, just like English, has developed and changed over time. Just like how, you know, Shakespearean plays talk a different way than we talk now. So this is actually super geeky about Hebrew grammar, but, you know, that's how I am. So think that ehye is like a modern day English. And what I'm about to show you is the old Shakespeare version of that same Hebrew phrase. So the older version of ehye is ehwe. And that's significant for a reason that you'll see in a moment. Because what God says to Moses is ehwe, I will be, and then with you, ima. Ehwe, ima, right? And I will be with you. So now God is saying, in about 5 minutes, I'm going to be with you, right? Ehwe ima, I'm going to be with you in 5 minutes or something like that. So what is this phrase, I will be with you? What does it mean? Does he mean at some point in the future, I will be with you, right? I'm going to spare you all the geeky grammar categories. But what this means is I am and will continue to be with you. It's a statement about the present ongoing into the future, which is why some of your translations don't have I will be, but simply I am with you. And that's because God is not saying in the future one day I will be with you, but I am here and from here on out. So I am and will be with you. So that's really what God is saying to Moses in that moment. So you can tuck that away, but we're going to keep reading. Who am I? It doesn't matter, Moses. I, Ehwe, will be with you. This will be the sign to you that it's I who have sent you. If you and your faith move out and do what I've asked you to do, when you've brought the people out of Egypt, you're going to come worship Elohim on this mountain. And this is the mountain that the Israelites camp out for a whole year later in Exodus, right? So it's significant. But Moses is like, okay, that evasive technique didn't work. So evasive technique number two, I'm going to try again, verse 13. Moses said, well, good. Suppose I go to the Israelites, though, and say that the Elohim of your fathers has sent me to you. They're going to ask me, what's his name? So what am I supposed to tell them? I don't know your name. So I'm not your guy. I'm not the expert on you. That's the implication. And so God responds to Moses with an actual answer. So there's no excuse. And Moses has accidentally equipped himself with the answer. So he says, Ehwe, Asher Ehwe. which it translates to I will be what I will be, or because of the dynamic about in 5 minutes, I will be who I will be. It's translated as I am who I am in our translations. So what's going on here? God is saying, whatever it is that I am that. And that's my name. And that's the significance of my name for you and for these people in slavery right now. So let's pause, because this is very profound, but has the tent, like has a chance of just slipping through our ears. Maybe you've heard the phrase before, I am who I am. And it just sounds very philosophical and cool. But let's keep reading and we kind of just move past it. That's usually how we approach it. But this actually is not that philosophical at all. It's a deeply personal character statement about Yahweh, who is the Elohim that we say we worship. And so we should hone in on this because it's a self-revelation. So what is God saying here? I am and will continue to be what I am and will be forever. So what God is saying is whatever character traits or attributes that God displays, he is that. It's as if he's saying, if you look up the dictionary for merciful, yeah, that's me. He is merciful. He is the perfect embodiment and the most consistent, reliable mercy that you will find anywhere in the universe. This is a God who clearly cares about how human beings treat each other and that they do so with love and with justice. So this is a God of justice. He is just, therefore he is the very definition of perfect and beautiful and full justice all the time, now and forever. And I am just now and will forever be just forever. And so this is in contrast to you and I, for example, because you and I are only sometimes what we are. So you have a friend and you really enjoy getting to know each other and you get along famously and you're like, man, what a great person of integrity. And they're so generous and so kind. They would be a really great roommate. And so then you become roommates and you get an apartment together, maybe even with a third person. But then what do you find out about this person that you thought was kind and generous and gracious and a man of God? You'll find that they're only sometimes kind and generous and gracious. If you're dating somebody and you're like, well, he's the most amazing man or she's the most amazing girl and he's so incredible or she's so generous and she's so kind and he's so whatever, and you marry him, and then you only realize after you're married that they're only sometimes that way, generous and kind. And that's human beings for you. We are only sometimes what we are, but Yahweh Elohim is what he is now and forever. So there's a huge difference there that needs to be caught. That's the idea here. You can depend on humans sometimes to be what they are. You can always depend on Yahweh to be what he is, and you never have to worry about Yahweh all of a sudden changing the rules on you and all of a sudden becomes something other than what you thought he was about. You always know where you stand with Yahweh. He keeps his word. And not only is he what he is, he's actually already revealed the first character trait by using his name right there, right? Because his name is Echweh, Asher Echweh, and he already said something that he will be earlier, which is Echweh with you, right? I will be with you. So this is yet another picture of Yahweh Elohim. So we don't look out at the world. So when we look out at the world and we assume that it's just messed up and you don't feel close to God or you don't sense God in the world at large, I certainly feel that way a lot of the time, given the year that we've lived through just now. And you might be asking, where is God? And the American Western conception of how we've come to define the word God, we think of some detached, far-off being who, if you believe in that God, he set the universe in play by whatever laws of physics, and he just lets it spin out, and Christians go into everlasting vacation at the end of time, and sometimes he might answer a prayer if you pray hard enough. That's how we view it sometimes. But the story of Yahweh Elohim is exactly the opposite. It's that God is not far off. He is with us, and he always will be with us. He is what he is. He is with us. And so people are suffering in slavery and being abused by other human beings in this story, and God is right there. He's hearing. If God is right there, then why doesn't he doing something about it? To which the Bible will say, well, what are people doing about it? Because God is calling them to do something about it. And that's what God is doing, right? So are you with me? It's allowing these stories to redefine the identity of God. When Christians are called to pray, like, may your kingdom come, may your will be done, I think we automatically default to, okay, God, go ahead, work your miracles, solve the problems of injustice, and just kind of go ahead and do that. Would you, please? Right? Whereas Jesus' conception of God is clearly that you actually begin to participate through obedience to his teaching on the actual ushering in of the kingdom of God in your day-to-day lives and relationships. So think about it. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. You are the answer to that prayer. And so these stories are trying to redefine even what it means for God to be present and active in this world. And so this God is fundamentally committed to be with his people, even when they are in deep suffering and slavery. That doesn't mean that God is not with them. That's one of the most powerful moments where he can reveal who he is. And who he is with us. So if you just keep going. Verse 14, God said, I am what I am. Whatever it is that I am that. And so God says, this is what you are to say to the Israelites. Ehwe has sent me to you. God also said to Moses, say to the Israelites, and then he says, not Ehwe, he says, Yahweh, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob has sent me to you. This is my name forever, and this is the name you shall call me from generation to generation. What's interesting is that when God says his name, he says Ehweh, which means I am and I will be. But when he puts his name in Moses' mouth to tell other people, he says Yahweh. And the difference between those two letters right there, right? This is straight up Hebrew grammar, but that Ehweh, and that Yahweh, that's the difference between I and he. So Ehweh is I will be, Yahweh is he will be, or he is. In other words, Moses, when Moses says, okay, here's the name of God, he doesn't say Ehweh, because then he'd be saying, I have sent you, I am has sent you. So you are what? Moses, what are you talking about? But when God's name is on other people's lips, they call him Yahweh, which means he will be, right? And so when we use God's name, he is who he is. And that's the story we just read. And it's kind of the foundation story for the revelation of God's name. What Elohim is it that creates the heavens and the earth, and whose story is told in the Bible? It's Yahweh. And it's Yahweh Elohim. So we're going to take one last step forward. So this is the name by which Yahweh said he's to be known. And it's a name that's not just any other name. It's a name that has deep meaning, an insight into this God's character. So now flip forward with me to the book of Deuteronomy, or mental note, right? So yeah, this is a mental dump of information, but hopefully you guys will get it. And I'm not sorry. So Deuteronomy chapter 5. If you look at the Bible, what do you find in chapter 5? Whoa, 10 commandments. So you've heard those before if you read Exodus. And I just want to look at the first commandment. It begins in verse 6, and this ties all of the pieces together, hopefully. And this is where this starts, why this is all significant for people who live in a culture of religious pluralism. So look at verse 6. He says, I am Yahweh, your Elohim. So name, right? Here's my name, Yahweh. Remember the ways we identify people by their name and by their story, and Yahweh uses them both. He says, my name is Yahweh, your Elohim, and just in case you forgot, I'm the particular Yahweh Elohim who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. This God is characterized by his mercy and his concern to rescue his people. So look at the implication in verse 7. You have no Elohim before me. So just stop right there. What does this verse assume? That there are other Elohim on offer in the culture around that they could give their allegiance to. Right? Are there other gods for them to give allegiance to? Well, here, yes. Should they? No. What did those gods ever do for Israel? That God didn't rescue them out of Egypt. What are those gods going to do for you that I haven't done for you 100 times over and even better? That's the idea here. They're not your gods. I'm the one who rescued you. I am Yahweh. I am your Elohim. It's acknowledging the fact that there are other Elohim, right? This might make your brain start to spin and question life, because you may have heard a fancy word here that refers to a common belief of Christians, Jews, and Muslims, namely the belief in one God, and that word is monotheism. And what that's often mistakenly thought to mean is, oh, I believe that there only exists one spiritual being, and that spiritual being is my God. That's just nowhere in the Bible. The Bible acknowledges the existence of many, many, many spiritual beings, and they all use the word Elohim. And Yahweh is among these Elohim, but Yahweh is the only one who is the creator of all that is in fact. He is the maker of all things visible and invisible, and also those spiritual beings as well. And so in the New Testament, sometimes they're called gods, but more often in the New Testament, they're called by a Greek word called daimon, which means lesser god or demigod. And it got transliterated into English as demon. And so immediately we're going to be led astray by images of Dante's Inferno and Caravaggio's paintings and Hieronymus Bosch's art of hooves and wings and red tails and pitchforks. And take a breath, which is actually ridiculous. And none of that is in the Bible. But there are spiritual beings, real ones, and there are people in other cultures and other religions that worship other Elohim. And they're not worshiping nothing. There is something there that they're really in touch with, and it's not Yahweh. And this is where we get into the scandalous claim of the story of the Bible, that Yahweh will continue to reveal himself as, we believe in Jesus, as the one true Elohim. That when you connect yourself to this God and give your allegiance to this God, you will find life, that you will rediscover your humanity and who you were made to be. And when you connect yourself to other Elohim, you will slowly die, and you will slowly be destroyed, because these other Elohim are out there. They don't have your best interest at heart. They might seem like they do, but they don't. And immediately you become unpopular at a Friday night party here in LA when you say something like that. And we'll talk about how to handle the awkward party conversation in a second. But here's the idea. Don't have any other gods. Flip the page to Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 4. And here's one of the most famous prayers and passages in the whole of the Old Testament. Verse 4, hear, O Israel, listen. Listen, O Israel, Yahweh, our God, Yahweh is one. Love Yahweh, your God, with all your heart, with your being, with all your strength. And these lines right here are called the Shema in Jewish tradition. And they have been prayed by devout Jews for over 3,000 years, morning, noon, and night. And this is the fundamental confession here, that all of the other Elohim that you could give your allegiance to, Yahweh is our Elohim. The one and only. It's saying that there are lots of Elohim out here on offer. We have only one, and his name is Yahweh, and he will be with us. And that's what the prayer is about. So many Elohim, Yahweh is our Elohim because he's the one who saved us. He is the God who looked down on us in our plight and in our slavery and had mercy and sent a deliverer that we could be rescued. So the last 2 pounds of information I'm going to shovel on you. This is who Yahweh reveals himself to be in the storyline of the Old Testament. And this is all in the context of religious pluralism. Many Elohim on offer, but Yahweh is ours. So the storyline develops, right? Jesus moves onto the scene and he begins, and we'll talk about this later on in the series as well. But he, both in his teaching and in his actions symbolically, walking around Israel-Palestine as if he was Yahweh. He's walking around doing and saying things that in their culture, only Yahweh had the prerogative to do. And in his setting, he was sending loud and clear signals about the claim he was making about himself. And so after Jesus' life and his death and resurrection, and the apostles started talking about Jesus, they began to use this language from the Old Testament, but redefine in light of who Jesus is. And so watch this. This is one of my favorite verses in the whole of the New Testament, and I won't make you look it up. It's right here in Paul's first letter to the Corinthians 8:5-6. So Paul is writing to a bunch of new Christians in a city called Corinth that is full of diverse gods and religions and so on. And the Christians are a minority, and nobody believes what they believe, and no one thinks what they think. So this is Paul's counsel for them. How do you go about discerning and growing as a Christian and talking about God? He says, listen, even if there are so-called gods, whether in heaven or on earth, as indeed, let's be clear, there are lots of gods and lords out there. There are many spiritual beings to which you could connect yourself to or give your allegiance to. Yet for us, there is but how many gods? One God. And so he's quoting the Shema right there. He's quoting the Shema prayer that we just read. We have one God, the Father, from whom all things came and for whom we live, and there is but one Lord, Jesus Christ, through whom all things came and through whom we live. And it's so crazy. It's so amazing what Paul is doing right there. right? He's using the language of Shema, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. And he says, there's a lot of gods out there that your friends worship or people say that they're in touch with. But for us, there's only one God and Father from whom all things come and exist from. We also have one Lord. When he says the word Lord, what is he referring to? The word Lord, when it's in Hebrew, is Yahweh, right? So wait, the Shema says, God is one. So who is the Father? Who's the Lord? Who's God and Lord? The Father or Jesus? That's Paul's point, right? Yes, it is. So it does, if it doesn't make sense, right? Because God is the most unique and holy thing in the universe, we believe. So if there's one thing that you need to make room for when you're thinking about God, is that it's going to utterly break categories that you have about how things work. And this being is the best candidate for that. So Paul has just broken the Shema open and stuffed Jesus right into it. And so who is God? Jesus or the Father or the Spirit? Yes, all three are one God for Christians, not for other people, not for the Buddhist, not for a Muslim. This is different, right? It's a different God. And it doesn't mean that you have to hate each other. But what it does mean is that you need to be able to disagree. And friends disagree. And then they go get some tacos and talk about it. And that doesn't mean you're a bad person. It doesn't mean that I'm a bad person. It just means that I think you're wrong, but we can still be friends. And that's part of what it means to be a human, is to recognize that we live in a pluralistic culture. So here's what happens. At the Friday night party, well, you can't do that right now because of quarantine, but in the future, maybe a Zoom party, you're being seen as a hater simply because you think someone else is wrong about their view of God. And that seems like it's very in touch and open-minded to like, oh, all roads lead to the same God. But what you're really doing is a dishonor to the people who actually believe in those religions, right? Like, do you think devout Muslims in Morocco actually believe, they think, believe that we worship the same God as Christians in California? Right? They don't think that. But Americans and young people all get bothered by it. So here's what it comes down to. We have so neutered and made ambiguous this word right here that we kind of just make it count for everybody. And we just all want to get along. So, you know, all paths lead up to the same God mountain. And while that seems very open-minded and a humble point of view, it's actually one of the most presumptuous and closed-minded views you can possibly have. Because what you're saying is, I'm an enlightened American, and I know that Christians and Hindus and Muslims are all wrong, and all religions are actually the same. And that's actually so presumptuous and entitled, but it comes off as a light enlightened in America. As Christians in this culture of tolerance, we're told to simply tolerate people who disagree with us. First of all, tolerate is something you do to your neighbor's crazy dog. What are the two greatest commands? Love God and love your neighbor as yourself. And to disagree with someone does not mean that you hate them. It means you respect them enough as a human and you respect their decision, and it's very different than your decision. You think they're wrong and they think you are wrong. Get some food and talk about it. That's okay. But Americans, we just have become so allergic to those kinds of conversations, and so we're unapologetic. A church full of people who believes Yahweh Elohim is our Elohim, and that he is a God that is so committed to being with his people and committing himself to broken, inward-focused, sinful human beings, that he not only just sent a deliverer, that he actually became a human being through the person of the Son in the power of the Spirit, so that he could absorb the pain and the sin and the guilt and all of the wreckage that's caused in our world, because I only sometimes say what I am what I say I am. And because all of our characters are so flawed and distorted that 7 billion of us making all sorts of inconsistent decisions make the world what it is. And this God doesn't sit aloof or far off. He comes to be among us to absorb the pain and sin and death onto himself on the cross, so that he can overcome it and conquer it by his love, and so that he can invite any human being who will come to him in faith to be invited into the heart of the love between the Father and the Son and the Spirit. We are not called to tolerate people we disagree with. We are called to love them and lovingly share what we believe, but precisely with the same attributes of mercy and generosity and goodness that Yahweh has shown to us. There you go. It's a lot to ponder. And as you know, I close off this podcast, this episode, maybe contemplate the next time you're going to partake in the cup and what it means to sit before sit before the elements of the story of this God who has come to redeem the world in his perfect and loving character. And so maybe there's some redefining that we need to do before that moment. Maybe you think that God just needs to do a magic thing and solve the problems in your life, and that's what it means for God to be God and for him to be with you. But could it be that God has been, is, and always will be with you, and he's not going to solve your problems at all because he has something higher on the agenda for you? And that is your growth and your development as a human being, and that is taking place precisely through the difficulty and the trial that he didn't cause, but you are growing through it. For some of us, we might just be trying to figure out whether we're going to give our full allegiance to him in faith or how we're going to make it through this quarantine. Okay. So to which I just say, who Yahweh Elohim is for you in Jesus is the best thing you have going for you. So just respond, call a friend, have a conversation about it. Take this seriously and just respond to his grace and taste and discover who Jesus is to you. The time in front of you is yours. This is the end of the episode. I hope that this was good for you, and feel free to leave a voice message in the chat. At the link in the description or on the page. Thanks for listening to Right Off the Transcript. Go in peace.